Hello, this is Nancy Emerson. I'm sitting with Verna Perino at her home in Mill Valley on February 23, 2015, and we are beginning her oral history. She will be telling about her life and especially her days in Mill Valley over the past 60-plus years.
Hello, my name is Verna Perino. I'm an old lady. I'm 98 years old. I've lived in Mill Valley for 60 years. And I have a story I'd like to tell you about the olden days and how we happened to have such a grand community center to greet you as you enter our city. It's a romantic tale, not about sex, but about adventure and all the wonderful things that happened in order to bring about this community center. So let's get started with the story. Communities get together and help form youth advisory committees, and that's what happened in Mill Valley. The youngsters wanted to have dances, but they were a little too rambunctious, and they had to have chaperones. So they formed a youth committee, and they had meetings, as committees do, and they formed dances with chaperones that were well chaperoned, and they arranged for jobs for young people to earn some money. And joining that committee was my husband, Dick Perino. He had lived in San Francisco and been a youth advisory committee working with young people. And I had been a Girl Scout leader for 20 years. And so other members of the community got together and worked to make it possible for young people to have dances. Now, it so happened that out on the Highway 101, there was a restaurant called Marvel Mar back in the 1940s. And the lady who owned it decided to sell it to a Charles Mosier. And Charles Mosier ran the restaurant, but he changed the name to the Colonel's Ranch Wagon. I don't know if any of you remember that Colonel's Ranch Wagon, but he had it for about 10 years, and then he decided he would like to build a motel. So he was going to tear it down. But rather than tear it down, the youth committee convinced him to sell it to the city of Mill Valley, sell it for a whole dollar. And with several community-spirited people encouraging the city council, the Park and Rec Commission, the Planning Commission, that's what happened. The Colonel's Ranch Wagon was sold for a dollar, but how to get it into Mill Valley from the highway? Now, that was another story. So what they did, they cut the building into three sections and then built a road from the highway near Goodman's Lumber, and narrow, winding, rough, and they hauled each of those three sections over that rough road, over Enchanted Knolls, and past where the police and fire station now are. Then they put it on a barge and hauled it across the bay and placed it onto a cement platform that was put there for that purpose. And then with many, 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 many volunteers, they put it all together again onto that slab. I'm probably the oldest person around still that has slides. We took many slides of that process, and I'd like to share them with you, beginning with the Colonel's ranch wagon and hauling over the hill and onto the barge and onto the cement, and then all the hard work. Weekend laborers, everybody came. Hal Schwartz was there all the time. He had a taxi service, and as the building took place, he had his phone installed in that building, and to this day, that very same phone is still the phone of the Park and Recreation Commission of Mill Valley. So that goes back a long ways. Bill Woods was there. He ran a tractor, and you could see him down there hauling dirt around and getting the land ready for the whole process. Joe Brewster worked so hard, and he was on Park and Rec, and Bill Secor worked so hard. So many others worked so hard, and of course they had to have some money in order to buy supplies, and I designed a poster of temperature showing how many dollars of the $25,000 we were trying to raise. That was a lot in those days. That was back in 1962. And we had that poster standing up at the corner of Throckmorton and Miller. And people kept looking to see how much money we had finally gained. Well, it finally got all put together, and to celebrate, there was a 4th of July parade. And since my husband had been the main spokesperson for urging city bodies to foster a park. It was called a youth and community center to begin with. It changed names several times. So Dick was asked to be the grand marshal of that parade, and all the youth groups started out at Old Mill School and then paraded down Miller Avenue. And the Goodman, or the Mill Valley Lumber Yard, loaned us their flatbed truck. And since I was a Girl Scout leader and my assistant Sunday school teacher was a leader of the Campfire Girls, we had the two groups on that truck together, youth groups working together. It was a big deal. And so then the next year, there was another parade, and this time they brought in a lot of circus-type events and beanbag throwing games and the whole project that had been called Project 17 acres of marshland for recreation purposes became a grand circus area. The youth center was used heavily, perhaps too heavily, and it's sort of worn out, and it was time to replace it. So then another committee was formed, and a new community and rec center was organized, and it was grand. It had a swimming pool that is really fantastic, and large meeting halls. In fact, I even taught classes in opera down there. Opera happened to be my love. And community meetings of all kinds, dinners and what have you, are held in that park or that rec and community center now. And it all started just because there were some rambunctious students that didn't have enough chaperones, and the community got together and bought a Colonel's Ranch Wagon for $1. That's the beginning of our wonderful Mill Valley Community Center, as I recall it.
Fantastic. Oh, but let me ask you two questions.
Okay.
Two questions. One is, do you recall how much money you hope to raise when you made the thermometer chart?
The first
poster.
One was $25,000.
Wow.
And we did it. Uh-huh. And we did it.
And you say that's the first one. Was there
that
another one?
That was the first one, yes.
Was there another one?
I don't know about the second one.
Okay.
That was a much more mammoth project, and with government help.
Oh yeah, for the new community center around 2000, whenever that was. Yeah, great.
That all grew out of the $1.
Another question I have is the person who had the taxi service.
Bob Robertson.
Okay, good. I just wanted you to clarify
Mill
that.
Mill Valley Taxi.
Okay. Great.
And that was 383-1370. There's one more thing I would like to add. In the olden days, when first coming to Mill Valley, there was on Highway 101 a stop-and-go light. So all traffic on 101 had to stop and go in order to enter East Blithedale or Tiburon. And then on East Blithedale, when you got to Lomita, the land was low. The water came up over the East Blithedale, so there was a trestle that went up over East Blithedale, and all cars had to go up over that trestle. That was there when I first came to Mill Valley in the 1940s from San Francisco as a member of a youth group, and we came to Alpine Hiking Club Lodge up on the ridge to have a weekend, and things were quite different in those days. But times change. Although Mill Valley still retains its quaint character, it's more of a boutique character now, with houses getting larger, being added to, but it all started back there with that $1 gift to the city. So I think it's a lovely adventure story to remember. Thank you.
This is Nancy Emerson. This is the continuation of my oral history interview with Verna Perino on February 23rd. 2015.
I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I went to the University of Minnesota, graduated, and then worked at the Mayo Clinic in the business office for a couple of years. Then in 1942, after the war had broken out, I came out to visit my brother in Berkeley, who was working on his PhD in 41, and I liked San Francisco so much that the next year, in 1942, I moved out to San Francisco. And as a member of First Methodist Church Youth Group, many of us came to Mill Valley to the Alpine Hiking Club Lodge up on the ridge and stayed overnight and hiked all the trails of Mount Tamalpais, going up to the top and down into Muir Woods. And we sang songs as we hiked along. And the group was called the Candlelight Group. And from that group, there were many service personnel, Navy and Army and Coast Guard and others, and many marriages were formed, and some friendships still last and have corresponded about the days of hiking Mill Valley streets and Mount Tamalpais. And always coming down, when we got the bus, we would stop at Espasti's Ice Cream Parlor. I don't know if that's there still, but everybody had to have ice cream cones, and that was part of the deal. I never knew in those days that many years later, I would wind up buying a house in Mill Valley and living here for 60 years. That was just unheard of. But I love little old Mallee, and I still do. No matter where I go, I love coming home to Mill Valley. My daughter was born here and went to Park School and Edna McGuire and Tamalpais High School. She learned to play a violin and played in the orchestra, and music became a way of life for her. And to this day, there are still those people that went to Mill Valley schools that get together and recently had a picnic in Old Mill Park. And I remembered so many of those names. I had a big car, and I used to pick up students in the music department through those narrow, narrow, winding roads going up Tamalpais High School roads. And friends of mine did too. They rather held their breath as I made those corners. In the early days, there was a Norman Black who had a flower shop. And for Easter time, he arranged to have a little barnyard in front of the depot, and all fenced in, and there were chickens and ducks and an angry goose that was always snapping at people, and bunnies. And they also arranged to have flower boxes in front of many of the stores. And some of my brownies dressed up as bunnies with watering cans used to wander around watering all those flowers. And I have a lot of newspaper photos of the girls doing that. another project at the Chamber of Commerce was I took the Girl Scouts to the waterfalls on Cascade Road and showed them various wildflowers there. Is that? And they mapped the wildflowers up and down that waterfall, and the chamber printed them and gave them out to visitors so that they could go visit the waterfall and look up the various kinds of wildflowers that were there. There were a lot of civic projects to earn money, and in Boyle Park, living across from Boyle Park, there were sometimes festivals over there, and they would have games for people to play for money, and they could buy things. In fact, the stained glass square that's hanging in my bedroom window was bought at a festival over there, and there's another one in another bedroom window. So Mill Valley has always been a civic-minded town, and people have gotten together for many different projects to make our community a delightful community in which to live. It's different from any other community that I can think of in Marin County. And I think the library has a lot to do with it. It was an original Carnegie library, and to build such a gorgeous building and have so many wonderful programs for all ages, from the youngsters on up, and rentals of all kinds and meetings of all kinds, bringing people in for lectures. Now that I don't drive, I don't get to go out that much, but I can't wonder but how great it is to live in a community like Mill Valley. I am so fortunate. I count my blessings. People keep up their yards. They appreciate their town. They appreciate the people in the town. And I just feel so fortunate, so lucky to live here. It's fantastic, fantastic. Thank you.
Would you feel like talking about your role as the opera lady? Or shall we save that for later?
Oh, I am so lucky because I have a passion. And I grew up listening to the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts and enjoying opera. And after my husband died in 1967, weekends were very lonely, and I went back to opera and symphony and became a volunteer for both organizations. A docent going into the schools for both opera and symphony, and explaining the background of composers and the music, but particularly opera, And I enjoy having other people learn about opera so that they can have as much enjoyment as I do. So for 29 years as a member of the Marin chapter of the San Francisco Opera Guild and as the chairman of the San Francisco Opera Guild preview program for all the Bay Area, I researched and arranged for opera authorities to come to Mill Valley and the Bay Area and give lectures with illustrated music, DVDs, and so forth, and became engrossed with Richard Wagner's operas. They tell the story of humanity, and it's pretty much based on mythology from all over the world, which is pretty much the same when you study Joseph Campbell. Mythology is pretty much the same. And as a result, I've had the very good fortune of being able to travel all over the world to see Wagner's cycle of four operas, Der Ring des Nibelungen, The Ring of the Nibelungen. And it's based on mythology, but because that way you don't base it on people, but you base it on generalities. And because I'm so old, and I've seen so many ring cycles, people like to talk to me about why. Why in the world do I keep going? And so in Shanghai, they sent me an email interview, and the next day they published it with my picture in Shanghai, and in Seattle, they had me on the radio, and on the that was a year before. They've had me. Oh, I went to Palermo. I'd never been to Sicily, and I went to Palermo because the daughter of my friend was singing the lead soprano in Brunhilde. And during the first intermission, they came up to me, "Would you answer a question, sir? And may we take your picture?" "Well, can't you wait until after the next intermission?" "No, we'll take it right now." They did, and the next day it was in the paper. Sicilian, I had to get that translated. I had three people translating the Chinese, and I've had someone from Germany get in touch with someone from Shanghai, get in touch with me to talk to me for a documentary, and I don't know if that ever came about, but everybody has a right to their own opinion about what Wagner means, and there are more books written about Wagner than anybody else other than Jesus Christ or Napoleon. Everybody gets into the act. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody says this or says that. And they all say, Wagner meant this, And Wagner meant that. You never get through. There are more organizations dealing with Wagner than any other composer. No wonder I never get tired of talking about Wagner and comparing Wagner's characters to what we see around about us. They're all out there. All the crooks, they're all in Wagner. All the greed, all the meanness, the goodness, everything is in Wagner. You can find it there. You never get tired of even in the music. And there are, of course, lots of people that cannot stand Wagner because he was anti-Semitic. Okay, he wasn't a very nice man, but never was their music written the way Wagner wrote music. The ending of Gedichtsammlung, the fourth opera, is so convoluted. It tells the world story from the least little thing. It's there. It's right there. And when you get to the end, it's impossible to keep up with. You've got the motifs and the melodies, and they stand for love or hate or something else. And you don't need the words. You can just listen to the music and you know exactly what's going on in that opera. No other opera can do that for you. No wonder people go crazy about Wagner. No wonder I have so many recordings. You get fast and you get slow and you can get interpretation. And that the first time I was given the Schulte Ring recording of the whole four operas, and that last disc I played over and over and over and over again. It was so convoluted. It told what was happening in the beginning and all the way through. And you could just live each one of those characters. I get carried away.
How many performances of the Ring Cycle have you attended?
Of the Ring Cycle, 76. It was supposed to be 76 in May, 77 in May. So it's been 76. And I've seen many individual operas as well as the four operas and many other Wagner operas like Lohengrin is one of those beautiful operas, and you get familiar music. Here Comes the Bride, Fair, Fat, and Wide. You know that one. And Tannhäuser, or Meistersinger, is considered Deutschland über alles, but it isn't. It is German art over everything, not German nationalism. And the Flying Dutchman was a very early one, and that was, he was, Wagner was always in debt, and he was always escaping his debtors. His Tannhäuser was revolutionary, and he performed that in Paris. And because the gentlemen wanted to take their dancers out after the second act, and Wagner put the dancing in after the first act, they had a claque that booed and yelled and threw things and ruined the production because they didn't like that. That ruined Tannhäuser. So anytime you hear Tannhäuser, you remember what they did to that one. And there are 10 major operas, and they did all 10 major operas in Berlin in one session, one right after the other. Barenboim, how he managed to do that, I don't know. But twice in a row he did that.
The 76 rings that you went to, ring cycles?
76 ring cycles.
How many countries?
That's, and for my 73rd, I was in Melbourne, Australia, and they had a soiree for me with a birthday cake. And they gave me a CD lecture, a very famous lecturer, and in April that lecturer will be coming here to lecture. And very intelligent, he goes all over the world to lecture. So I've got to be up and at him for that, mm-hmm. to hear him again. I had such a good time in Seattle that time that I decided I've got to go again someplace. So I discovered they were doing an Enescu festival in Romania. I can't even pronounce Enescu. And I went there, and they were having interviews, and they picked me out upstairs. And you're not from here, no. I'm from San Francisco. San Francisco? How come you came from so far? So they interviewed me there, and I explained that music is a universal language, that everybody understands music, even though they're different languages. Even in Romania, where else? Oh, I was in Cologne, and they had banners hanging outside the opera house, and a man was taking a picture, and I said, would you take a picture of me in front of the banners? Sure. And he was from Oslo. And I said, oh, I've been in Oslo to the ring, and you had the most wonderful ski jumps there. Yes, we did. You were there? And so we talked about that. And then in Shanghai, the man who got my tickets took me down to the front row center and had a photographer there. And then a man way over on the side stood up, "Who's this celebrity?" "Oh my gosh, it's Verna!" So he joined our group. And you meet people everywhere when you attend Wagner. Oh, and another one. I was in New York for that crazy LePage ring, and talking to a lady from New York who was talking to a man from Florida, and she said something about how Wagner keeps me alive. And he said, "What did you say your name was?" "Verna Perino." "You're the woman in the book." He had just read about me in a book that had just come out.
What was
that
book?
So I've got the book in here, and they've got me in with three other very famous Wagnerians. Father Owen Lee, who is on the Met intermission, and Spate Jenkins, who is just retired from Seattle Opera, and Brian McGee from London. Me with those three famous people.
Fantastic.
And that was when I had a stroke and they sent the book to me. Life is amazing when you get into Wagner.
It's a whole lifestyle. Okay, I think that we should stop, don't you? And rest, okay?
I did it.
You did great.